Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Welcome to Silmarillion Stories, where the Lorehound's your guides to Tolkien's world of Middle-earth. I'm John, and this is our podcast for Of the Coming of Men into the West, the 19th portion of the Silmarillion. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the Houses of the Edain and the Friendship of Fingolfin. If you want to get in on the Tolkien talk, send an email to lotr@thelorehounds.com or visit thelorehounds.com/contact to leave a voicemail. One more note, if you want to support us directly, click the link tree in the show notes and follow it to Supercaster Patreon, where you can get ad-free access to all of our podcasts and bonus content like Second Breakfast and Elevensies. Today, our returning guest is, of course, Marilyn Arbuckila, our favorite Tolkien scholar and host of Rings and Rituals. Marilyn, welcome back.
Hello, John. Thank you. It's great to be back, as always.
This is the first time we've done two in a row in a while, right?
I think ever.
Maybe.
But memory may not serve in this case.
Maybe. So. The Silmarillion Stories has been an ongoing journey in formatting since David and I were doing it. And then James is like, oh, I'm out.
Right.
Yeah, rotating guests. But I do remember that you were here for the first chapter about men. You were here for Of Men. So yes. I'm glad that you're here to do Of the Coming of Men.
Well, there you go.
Into the West.
It's nice to be consistent.
Exactly. So, Marilyn, again, could you just remind people of your background on Tolkien in case this happens to be their first chapter of the Silmarillion and they're coming into this for some reason?
Sure thing. I taught a course on Tolkien off and on for 35 years during my career at Colby College as an academic research librarian. I've served as a research assistant for the Prancing Pony podcast, and I've done a lot of guest interview type things on a variety of different Tolkien related podcasts. I answered a question that you guys put out to your listeners about the Barovian.
You did?
Society, the Tea Club and Barovian Society. And wow, didn't that open the floodgates?
It sure did. And then you covered all of Rings of Power season two with us. You covered all of Rings of Power season one with Dr. Sarah Brown. On the Rings and Rituals feed, and I think you're going to come back sometime before season three to cover season two. Is that right?
We absolutely are. It's a question of, you know, waiting until Sarah's schedule is not utterly insane.
Well, the good news is that TV moves at a snail's pace these days, so you have some time.
Yes, we do. And in the meantime, I'm writing book reviews for various Tolkien volumes of scholarship and not-so-scholarship as they come out. So, yeah, I've got two on the board right now, so...
Very good. So we're talking today about Of the Coming of Men into the West. So this it's mostly been an elf's game, this whole book, right? Quint of Silmarillion has been all about the elves. And now elves are still very much in this chapter, but we're finally going to meet some of our mannish counterparts.
Yes. Of course, the idea of the whole setup for Silmarillion is that these are elven histories. And so, obviously, they would be less interested in human histories until they actually meet and mingle and take important roles. I mean, we do hear about at least two, I think, groups of humans who migrate down to some other place and pass out of the histories.
Yes, so, we do.
You know, either you're in Beleriand and you're in contact with elves, or you just don't exist as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, and of course, I love that it's like, and the best of the men were the elf friends. You know, like, everyone who's good is our friend. Everyone who's bad is not our friend.
And it really depends on which elf you're talking to.
That's true. That's true. As we will see.
Yes, we will
see. So, why don't we talk about the first elf that meets the men, and that is Finrod Felagund, of course, king of Nargothrond. Is he king? He's lord. Lord of Nargothrond.
Lord of Nargothrond. Well, I think I've read both. He's called king and lord at various times.
He's almost like a small K king, because you still have the king of the Noldor.
Well, you have the high king.
Okay.
So, you know, Thingol calls himself king. I think it's perfectly fine if Finrod calls himself king. They're not calling themselves High King. And then there's the whole question of, does Thingol actually recognize the High Kingship? Because, you know,
he's
a Sindar, and the High King is an old daughter, and the old daughter.
I'm going to say no. He does not recognize the High Kingship.
I really don't think he does.
I'm pretty unequivocal on that one, actually.
They brought a lot of pain to Beleriand as far as the Sindar and the Green Elves are concerned.
Yeah, yeah. So Beor the Old, this is the first, I think this is the first named man we meet.
I believe that's true. I mean, there's allusions to famous humans, but I don't think Tolkien or Christopher gave us their names.
Yeah.
Just, you know, yes, and the coming of this particular hero, and then the coming of this particular hero that even Melian's girdle could not prevent.
I feel like there was a brief mention of Beren before this, but again, that's alluding to a future event. That's not meeting someone in their real time. So this is the first story about a man. We hear you have a note here about a rude harp.
Well, in the text, we read that Finrod hears singing in mountain area, and he's a little concerned because could this be a band of marauding orcs? I didn't think their singing was that bad, but anyway, from a distance, I guess, who knows? He gets closer and he sees that they're not orcs and they look like children of Iluvatar.
Mm-hmm.
And so after they hear them singing and with accompaniment, after they all fall asleep, he creeps into the camp and the text says he picks up a rude harp and begins playing upon it. And it's very reminiscent of the classic stories about elves and fairies who would play music of enchantment. Humans would hear it and they could actually see the things that the elf was singing about come before them. That's a particular gift of elvish musicians, supposedly. So this is harking back to a Prancing Pony podcast episode when they first did Silmarillion. This is a couple of years ago now. And they really love to riff on the rude harp. You know, did it have indigestion that day? Or, you know,
that's pretty funny.
Why was it rude? And so it became part of the first Prancing Pony podcast, Moot, which was online. And Katie had set up a D&D scenario, and I was mastering it along with Corey Olson because I had completely forgotten how to run combats. And so I was perfectly happy I had the script in front of me. I could really go on and fill in and exaggerate and tell stories and all that. And Corey did all the dice throwing and calculations. So it was a great combination.
Well, that's nice.
And the root hop was from Joyzy. When they picked him up, he said, "Hey, who are you? What, do you think you can play hop? What do you mean? Well, look what you're holding, man. Stop that." And it entered legend. So.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
I love the root harp.
The rude harp. So here's where we are. We've got Finrod kind of just moseying about in the fields, and over the mountains, over the Blue Mountains, come the House of Beor. Come the Edain, but first come the House of Beor, who becomes Beor the Old. And Finrod just kind of teaches them things by singing, it sounds like, right? He's just sitting there playing his harp, and it says each understands him according to their measure.
Right, right.
Again, which is really interesting.
That elvish ability to convey meaning, even though the languages are utterly different from one another. So I made another note that it's kind of a form of a Sanway.
Yes, yes. It says in the text that Finrod can read and can see into their minds, right? So
he's
able to speak with them both because he's good with language, but also because he can sense their inner meaning as well.
Right. So he can hear their thoughts. But to some degree, I think the human perception from the Elvish singing is that same form of Osanwe at work. Because what we know of Osanwe is that both humans and elves had it, although elves were a lot better at it than humans were.
Right. Right. It's interesting, this whole idea of getting into people's head through music. It almost reminds me of sort of conversations I've seen in academia of how do we write for the audience and not for other academics?
Oh, yeah. Important question.
It's a problem of many, you know, like educated professions of rather than speaking in technical language, how do you make something user-friendly? And it seems like Finrod automatically does that in the way he's conveying information to the men here.
Yeah, I like that. And you have to think, well, who is my audience? And if your audience is fellow academics, well, great. Talk about Foucault and, you know, lenses of this, that, or the other thing all you want. But if you know that you have, you know, reasonably scholarly listeners who are not English literature PhD holders or whatever, and you want them to hear what you have to say, you have to use the words and the language and the concepts that they are going to understand. Or else, why are you speaking to them at all?
Right. Look, men are a mixed bag. You got an Aragorn, you got a Wormtongue. You could get a lot of space in between there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think this is why Finrod is, I think he is actually called the Beloved. But I think when people are asked, who's your favorite elf from the First Age, I think a lot of people, Finrod is their go-to.
Finrod is pretty cool.
And in some respects, I think we see and hear more of his thoughts and deeds than of any other elf.
He's in a lot of stuff. He's at least sort of woven into other people's stories a lot.
Exactly. And other people weave themselves into his story.
Right. And we get these brief glimpses of his sister Galadriel in places. But really, I think that she would have also had a much more prominent role had Tolkien lived on a little longer.
I agree, because she wasn't there initially in his very early versions of what became the Silmarillion. She really didn't appear until he was writing Lord of the Rings. And at that point, his inspiration was much more Aisha, or she, from the late 1800s, I think, action-adventure novels. And quite a different character from what Galadriel became, but I mean, this was just the beginning, right? Galadriel has had so much transfiguration over the years of all the writings of Legendarium.
Right.
But I don't know if it was Tolkien himself or if it was Christopher who inserted her in a couple of places when the Silmarillion was put together, because they wanted to show that background. And some of the interesting touches to me are that they associated her very strongly with Melian, and I'll have more to say to that.
Yeah, that's true.
In a little while.
That's true. So, men, we get this background story on men, of course. Again, the race of men, if you're new here, Tolkien is talking about humans, but he refers to them as men in his works. So, men awoke, we find out, at Hildorian, and their hearts were calling them west. Mm-hmm. But when they awoke, Morgoth goes, huh, a new toy. He's the first one to notice them, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, and well, he's there on the ground, isn't he?
Exactly. And so he plays with them a while. He puts a darkness on them. But I really like this idea that the text says, you know, he was incomplete in putting that darkness upon them because the Eldar gave him so much trouble in the West, he had to return to Angband.
Yeah, so like so many of his projects, it was unfinished, as it were. Mm-hmm. I think equally, he was seeing them as a potential threat. And he
you
wanted
think
to
so?
Make, I do. I think he wanted to nail them down. He didn't know who they were. I mean, none of the Valar knew anything about the children of Iluvatar until they showed up in the world. And, you know, for Morgoth, he certainly got an up-close and personal view of the elves during the early ages, you know, before the sun and moon kind of thing. So here's a whole new thing, and who knew what Iluvatar had given them right. or put into them and so forth. So
right. Maybe when they die, they explode, and then I get attacked, you know?
Yeah, seriously.
Who knows?
I just don't see Morgoth doing much in the way of play. Fear, yes.
Well,
I think his motivations of fear are mentioned throughout. He feared and he hated.
Hmm.
It's amazing how many times that phrase is ascribed to him.
Yeah. Yeah. And he gets quite angry later at the men, but we'll get there
in
a little bit. I do like, though, that sort of Morgoth feels more, he feels like he wants to be friends with the elves in some ways. Like when he's in Valinor, he's pretty tight with the elves in some ways. But I think he really wanted I think he almost saw men as his children. I saw a Reddit post once that got me thinking. They said, you know, what could Melkor have been if he had not fallen to the dark? Could he mm-hmm. have perhaps been the Vala who most showed himself and helped men? Because the Valar are really absent for men. You know, they're present mm-hmm. in spirit, but they don't really appear to men very often, especially compared to the elves. And could Melkor in his angelic form have been a better role model for men, you know?
Well, as I understand it, I mean, if you accept Melkor as a sort of a stand-in for Lucifer, as I understand it, in Arabic story, in Muslim story, this being is called Shaitan, who is the greatest of all the archangels and wants to spend all his time at the feet of God.
Mm.
Only wants to serve God, no one else. And then God propounds these new creatures called humans, and he wants all of his angels to serve the humans.
Mm-hmm.
And Shaitan refuses and says, I only want to serve God. And that was his fall. So there's possibly a little connection there. Now, listeners, if anyone knows the Muslim stories better than I do, please write in and correct me on that. That's what I understand at this point. But I'm sure there's nuances that I have not heard or overlooked.
And Robert Jordan also takes Shaitan from that story and puts that as the name of the dark, one of the names of the Dark One in The Wheel of Time. I like when these authors take from different cultures and they mishmash them into different fairy tale stories.
A whole new kaleidoscope.
Yeah, definitely. So we got that backstory that men are sort of partially darkened. The darkness of Morgoth has gotten to their door, but it didn't get let in, I like to think. But there are other men besides the House of Beor. And we've got the House of Beor, which we've already met, and they're the ones who are going to be closest with the elves.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the House of Haladin, and mm-hmm. that is the house that speaks the same tongue as the House of Beor. They are sort of allies more when they were in the East, mm-hmm. and they're going to come over next. And then we've got the House of Marok, which are this warrior type of men, and they seem like tough guys. You don't want to mess with them.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, well, Tolkien loves to describe different peoples in terms of their physical appearance and characteristics. And so the Beor's people were slighter of build, dark of hair, gray of eyes. I mean, think Edith again, because she becomes the model for, you know, the finest, whether it's elves or humans. I believe it was the Haladin who were tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. And to my mind, sounded very much like very, very early Proto-Rohirrim.
Mm.
And then the Marach, do you remember how the Marach are described?
You know, I just want to correct myself. I had before said that the Haladin had the same speech. It was the House of Marach that had the same speech.
That's
the House of Haladin
thought.
Have their speech sundered.
Because
that's
they
what
were
I wrote
so
in my
separate.
Notes.
Yeah,
yes,
they were
they
so
were
separated.
Very separate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So nobody at me. Y'all heard my correction.
And
the
maybe
House of Haladin
it was,
spoke a different tongue.
Maybe it was the House of Marok who looked like Proto Rohirrim, but I think it was the Haladin because of Halad that we'll get to in a minute.
Okay. Okay. That would make sense to me. I would be good with that.
Yeah.
But Marok was the house that was closer with Beor.
Right.
I just wanted to be clear on that before we move on. And so the Green Elves are very unhappy because there's all these men going across Assyrian, which Assyrian, if you take a look at the map of Beleriand, you'll see that it's all these rivers. And I think that's such a cool idea that it's just this little area in the southeast corner of Beleriand where you have all these rivers flowing just in lines.
And Treebeard remembers wandering in that country
mm-hmm.
in his youth, the seven rivers of Osir, as he describes it.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful idea. And so the Green Elves are very displeased that all these men are treading over their rivers and causing a ruckus. They're very loud. And so Finrod says, all right, I'm going to settle you elsewhere because obviously nobody's getting along over here. And he helps them found Estolad, which mm-hmm. is going to be their home for a while. But Beor decides, no, I'm actually going to go back to Nargothrond with Finrod and I'm going to serve under him.
Yeah. He's almost a bit like the Light Elves. When they get to Valinor, they, you know, walk up the hill and they sit at the feet of Manwë and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
Beor, you know, he sees Finrod, recognizes him as this amazing creature and wants to pledge his life and support to him and says bye to his folks and off he goes.
Yeah.
One of the things I remember about the Green Elves, they were unhappy because these people are hunters and hewers of wood.
Yes.
And we will be unfriends with them forever.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of spoilers for Rings of Power Season 2, so fast forward a couple minutes if you don't want this. But it reminds me of the Entwife being very upset
with
Arondir and with Isildur for being hewers of trees, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and of course, I think of the creation of the dwarves. And the last line in that particular story is Aule saying, and nevertheless, they will have need of wood.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Honestly, that's one of my favorite early stories because you can feel like the husband-wife bickering there.
It's beautiful, isn't it? It's really wonderful.
There's a trend going on TikTok right now where husbands and wives or partners in general are they're standing next to each other and they go in unison, we listen and we don't judge. And then they take turns telling each other things that like they hide or something like that. It's like, I pretend you clogged the toilet. And I just think of Aule and Yavanna there together. We listen and we don't judge. Nevertheless, they'll have need of wood.
Right. Well, they still better watch out for my ants.
Right. Right. Okay. Okay.
But I have to wonder, you know, how the Green Elves keep warm.
Mm.
And are they strict vegans?
I wonder. I don't know.
You know?
Do you know about the this diet where you only eat fruit of things? Nothing that will kill anything? What am I thinking of?
Yeah, I have heard mention of that. I'm not sure what it is. I think it would be a very uncomfortable diet in terms of your digestive system.
No, it's a religious thing, though. It's
Oh, I understand. I understand. But why not, you know, why not whole grains at least?
Yeah. Anyway, I think it's that you can't, I think the philosophy is you can't have anything that will kill a living being, including a plant. So you can only eat things like fruit,
the things that they drop.
Milk, eggs, you know, something that's not actually going to kill a living thing.
But it's if you're harvesting grain, you're not killing the grain. You're not, I mean, you're not.
Well, maybe that's allowed. I don't know.
So, okay.
I don't know.
Okay. Listeners, write in.
Yeah. I can't think of this. I used to know this. I can't think of it, Marilyn.
It will come back to you. When it does, we can just put a little insert in.
That's true. That's true. So let's go on to Haladin. Let's go to the House of Haladin. Haladin's people moved near Caranthir, so we're back to the Sons of Feanor. And then Maruk moved near the House of Beor and struck up an alliance, because they were already buddies.
Yeah.
And Fingolfin hears about all this, and he welcomes them, and he's like, hey, let's all further integrate. So he opens up the houses to have, you know, wards and serving under elvish lords, and all the men are like, cool, we get all this free education and we get to live in castles and everyone's happy.
Eat better food.
Exactly.
Play better music.
Exactly. It's interesting because you see this cycle of, this is sort of the waxing of the relationship between the two, of the intermingling. And towards the end of the chapter, you get sort of the waning, right? You get this idea of, all right, maybe we got a little too close for comfort.
Well, nothing good ever lasts.
I know.
Sort of a subtext for a lot of Tolkien, I'm afraid.
Yeah. I see you have a lot of notes on the next one, so I'm going to go right to it. Because okay. Right now I've just been listing off where people move. The House of Beor moves to Dorthonion. That one always throws me off because I want to say onion. Dorthonion. Marok mostly moves to Hithlum, but a portion of Marok's people go elsewhere to Arid Wethryn. Now, if none of that makes sense to you, it's okay. Just know that the peoples of House of Beor and Marok are sort of moving in different directions here. Thingol is big mad. He's big mad.
When is he ever happy?
I know. I feel like he constantly has steam coming out of his ears. The guy just could heat a furnace with all the steam coming out.
Well, at least since the coming of the Noldor, let's put it that way. I'm sure he and Melian enjoyed their 500 years staring into each other's eyes.
Yeah, exactly.
And the early days of building Doriath and so forth.
He used up all the calmness of his being during those 500 years, and the rest of it is just anger.
Kind of sounds that way.
So he's really mad, and he's like, "Men, you can't even come to Doriath." And they're like, "Okay, we didn't even try to, but..."
Whatever.
"We don't even want your weird girdle." And he tells all the other elf lords, you know, if you are harboring these little twerps and they mess up, you are responsible for them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we love it. If your puppy messes in my dining room, you're going to hear about it.
But of course, this is where Galadriel comes into the story.
Yes.
And Melian turns to Galadriel. She's like, "I'm not going to say this to my husband because he doesn't have ears for this right now.
He doesn't ever listen to me anyway."
Exactly.
Not anymore.
Exactly. And she says to Galadriel, "Now the world runs on swiftly to great tidings, and one of men, even of Beor's house, shall indeed come, and the girdle of Melian shall not restrain him. For doom greater than my power shall send him, and the songs that shall spring from that coming shall endure when all Middle-earth is changed."
Yeah, so what or who is this doom that's greater than her power sending?
Yeah.
Baron into the realm of Doriath.
Yep. Spoilers. It's going to be a big story. We're going to spend multiple episodes on it.
Yes, yes indeed. And it continues on, as she says. This is still the first stage, but... The outcomes of this particular encounter will resonate throughout the second age and the third age.
Yep. So you've got a lot of notes here, so I want to give you space to bring in some new ideas.
Yeah, well, I think in part of this is interesting to see the internal politics between Noldor and Sindor, and to some degree with the Green Elves. You know, we usually hear about one group or another doing something, but here we get sort of all of them kind of saying, well, you know, NIMBYism not in my backyard, or good heavens, what are you doing with those weak creatures? Or, oh my gosh, I guess they're not so bad after all, after half of them have died defending their home from orc raids. And maybe I will take them under my wing after all. They could be you know, useful cannon fodder. I mean, I'm being somewhat cynical about it because this is one of the sea elves, you know, those sea elves were not SEA, but letter C elves, Cúrufin, out there. They don't wind up showing themselves in a very good light as things progress. But.
No, they don't. But in this chapter, they're honestly pretty good in this chapter.
They are. No, they are. I will give them that. They haven't, I guess, their daddy's curse is kind of sleeping for the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I find interesting, humans cross the mountains looking for peace. But yet, when they're offered chances for war, they're all excited about that. Although some do try to escape the war too, but some of them, particularly Beor and Hod, are just re-up under the Elven lords.
Yeah,
You know,
I think it's a hard drug to quit. Violence.
I don't know. I mean, we don't know anything about whatever kind of violence and warfare they were fleeing from before.
Right. Probably orcs, right? Because this is all Morgoth.
Well, it could be other humans. It could be other humans too, who came under Morgoth's influence. You know, the Tolkien is so vague about this, and I think the reason for that is this is his version of the story of Eden, Middle Earth style.
Mm-hmm.
that he's not going to actually have a serpent and a tree and an apple and all that kind of thing, because that would be way overloading right. the primary world imagery. But we have Melkor as an explanation for why humans migrated, and this is the closest that Tolkien will come to the Garden of Eden and the serpent in Arda. So,
right.
you know, once again, Melkor is Arda's serpent, if you like.
We'll just let a spider be on the tree. We don't need a serpent.
Yeah, and no fruit, you guys. No fruit for you. So, I mean, for some of them, it's a wonderful thing to re-up under the Elven Lords, but it really didn't do a lot of good for one or two houses that we'll be hearing more about as
right.
time goes on.
Right.
And, you know, Thingol is just continuing in a rather poor light, as we've already said, grumbling about interlopers and trying to hem people into small corners and out of the way pockets. Though, of course, the Green Elves weren't much better either. I mean, they coined the term unfriends, which has all kinds of resonances nowadays with social media and whatnot, which is kind of funny.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close.
Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
It's really interesting. I want to ask you, why do you think the Noldor are so much more friendly to men than the other elves?
Well, I mean, if you think about the Sindar, they have their enclosed kingdom. They were already sundered from the Noldor by language and, you know, by being apart for however many thousands of sun years that was before the Noldor came back. They were pretty much established in Beleriand and, you know, for a long time holding their own. Things were starting to get more desperate as more orcs came along. And in the first instance, they thought that the Noldor had come at the bidding of the Valar to help them resist the orcs. And they said, oh, great, you're arriving just in time. This is wonderful. And then they find out, oh, gosh, they're actually going to start taking over our land. And they didn't ask us about this. And they're establishing their kingdoms. And, hey, what about me? You know, I'm the High King here. Except he wasn't High King of the Noldor. And so Thingol just gets on his high horse. And, you know, nobody likes somebody on their high horse, right? And is not necessarily helping the Noldor specifically with their battles. And, you know, along come the humans, and he's like, oh, gosh, these are even worse. And, you know,
yeah.
get off my lawn.
So are you telling me that these are basically just two immigrant communities finding camaraderie?
Well, I really think that there's a lot more to looking at these stories through the lens of immigration.
Hmm.
Because
that's a very interesting idea. I never considered that, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, think about it. Everybody in this story is migrating of the children of Ilúvatar. The only ones that stay in place, well, even the Valar migrated from one place to another as Morgoth destroyed it. But we get this notion that migration is an exception.
Right.
Because, you know, as soon as a new people move into an established area where people already were, they're the newcomers, you know, this is our place, that whole dynamic and tension comes along. And
mm-hmm.
the irony is, of course, in this country, we're all newcomers. We're all migrators.
Yeah.
Unless we are of, you know, American Indian descent.
But of course, that is a relative a relatively modern idea, right? This idea of mass migration. Other than, you know, there have been points in history where this has happened, but what I mean is for the last like 1,000 years, it was much less common for populations to, you know, become the melting pot of America, if we're going to use that you know, that term that everybody loves to use.
Well, but that's
like, this is a new thing.
I push back a little on the newness of it all. I mean, if you think about the origin of the human species, which is mm-hmm. what we're talking about here in Silmarillion terms, we all migrated out of Africa.
Yeah,
I'm
definitely not disputing that people have migrated over history.
Okay. Don't worry. But we seem to forget that.
This idea of like individuals freely just going to whatever country they want to live in. And I know there's plenty of reasons people can't do that. Money, travel restrictions,
sure.
all that.
Sure.
But this is the most freedom of travel we've ever had. So you're right that the idea that these populations are just coming over, just finding a new place, that would have been something that felt new in Tolkien's world, I think.
I suppose their archaeological knowledge and anthropological knowledge wasn't as great as ours is now, but I think they knew enough about the Celts, for example, to know that they migrated across, you know,
all right, well, then I'm just making it all up, Marilyn.
So
that's fine.
No, I think much depends on how you view history and how you're, how you're framing this.
Yeah.
And I think I'm not sure that Tolkien was even conscious about writing stories of migration, but
yeah, I mean, he even basically adapts the Bering Strait story, right? By doing the Helcaraxe.
Right. And you have the hobbits, you know, wandering across mountains and so on and so on. So, mm-hmm. I think in the Shire, we see an example of we think of as, okay, this is what a settled and orderly community is like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's eventually protected by King Elisar when he decrees that no big people will ever enter the Shire. So, okay, they're set there now. But that still is, wow, really the exception.
Mm-hmm.
The elves are known for traveling west in the Third Age.
Mm.
The Rohirrim, 500 years earlier, migrated down from the north. The Numenoreans migrated from the destruction of Numenor. So, I suppose it depends on the scope of your historical land. I mean, within a 100-year period, you know, I've lived here, my grandfather's lived here, and so forth. That gives you a sense of rootedness. And yet, if you start looking a little more closely, I think there may be more migration going on there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, my grandfather moved from Europe, so.
Sure.
I'm no stranger to immigration.
Well, and I had one side of my family came over in the 1600s, and the other side of my family migrated from Finland in 1912.
Oh, no, we're all recent on my family. We're all, like, I think the latest one was, like, late 1800s.
Okay.
Yep. All right. So, or the earliest one, rather. Anyway.
Yeah.
My point is, I think I was just wrong. I think that Thingol is just a xenophobe, and he kind of sucks.
Well, but he's not unlike Turgon in some respects,
mm-hmm.
in that both of them have sought to create safe communities for their peoples by shutting themselves in and hiding themselves away. By building a girdle or finding a place led by a Valar, for crying out loud,
mm-hmm.
to a secret place encircled by mountains.
Yeah, you can only see it from atop an eagle.
Right, and in that instance, you're never allowed to leave. I don't know if Thingol ever puts that kind of restrictions on the people of Doriath, but maybe he doesn't feel the need to because he feels that the Girdle of Melian should be strong enough to
I think that's probably true. Yeah, it never felt as restricted as Gondolin. Gondolin felt
closed
society.
Yeah.
And but also, so, Doriath is so much bigger, it feels like.
Well, that's true in terms of literal acreage.
Yeah,
there's a lot more. Doriath.
Not just Menegroth, but Doriath as a whole. There's just more there.
No, you're right. You're right. Whereas Gondolin is kind of a gated community. Let's mm-hmm. face it.
Yeah, that's the country club of the Elven kingdoms.
But they didn't invent the game of golf. That was the hobbits. And I was also really interested to see this conversation between Melian and Galadriel, and I'm wondering mm-hmm. why. they gave that role to Galadriel, whoever it was, whether it was Tolkien initially or if Christopher put this in, because of course you get the resonance of the secret realm
mm-hmm.
that people talk about but don't necessarily enter. And that's pretty much what Galadriel eventually sets up in Lothlorien.
Yeah.
And so I wonder how much she thought about this once she found herself queen of the guarded forest realm. She left before Thingol's death and Melian's departure.
Hmm.
According to, you know, some of the texts. I think most of the different stories of Galadriel would all match with that. I think by the time Thingol was killed, Galadriel was out of the picture as far as Beleriand was concerned, but
okay.
I won't swear to it.
I almost feel like, and this perhaps is just because Tolkien didn't have time to give her a more active role, but I almost feel like to start weaving her into the First Age, Tolkien just had Galadriel as witness to a lot of these events, right?
Yes, I would
witness
say
so. To a lot of these events, learn from them, and that way by the time she's in the Second Age, she is wise enough to rule her own kingdom.
Mm-hmm. And once he figured out her ancestry and figured out that she was sister to Finrod, he uses her as a means of stimulating Finrod's self prediction that he will never marry. So she serves an interesting role in a couple of places.
Mm.
Including, you know, the first evidence that Thingol gets of the kinslaying. You know, when Galadriel shows up and he says, "Oh, my relative, you're welcome," and so on. And,
yeah.
And Melian looks at her and says, "You know, there's something going on at the back of your head that you're not telling."
Yeah, exactly.
And like, Galadriel replies, "Yeah, there was more." This is where Melian says, "The Noldor did not come at the bidding of the Valar just to help us
mm-hmm.
gain victory over Morgoth." And Galadriel said, "Well, you're right about that, but you're not going to learn any more about it from me."
Right.
So.
Well, we've got more deceivers in our midst.
Oh, we do.
So we've got to talk about the bad guys. Beregg, who's from the House of Beor, and Amlach from the House of Maarak. So these guys, they're not very happy with the way things are going. And they start to go, like, why are we even friends with the elves? What's in it for us?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, everyone's starting to get a little rowdy. And one who appears to be Amlach says, it's all been a lie. You know, we should coexist with orcs. And there's enough room for everybody as long as the elves leave us alone. They're the real problem. And he goes away, and then the real Amlach comes in and goes, "Hey, where's the party at?" And they all look at him like he's a ghost, and he's like, "Wait, I didn't say any of that." So they realize then most of the men then go, "Okay, we are being played here.
Right.
And we are being sent into a battle on the wrong side. So let's not do that." A few people go with Beregg to, you know, sort of strike out and leave the whole situation. They kind of fall out of history, right?
Right.
And then some of the people under Amlach also follow Beregg. But Amlach himself goes, "Oh no, now I have a bone to pick.
Right.
Now I have personal beef with this Morgoth guy.
It's gotten personal."
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty funny. It's like, you know, I don't understand people who are just like, "No, it has to get personal before I care."
Well, I mean, if you've been undergoing a generations-long migration from a really long distance away to avoid war,
yeah,
I can understand why you might just say, "Look, these guys are way out of our mm-hmm. league. What are we doing thinking we can give them anything? Let's just try and find a place where they'll leave us alone and we can live our lives as peacefully as possible. We thought there was peace here. Now we find out it's a whole half-continent away on the other side of an ocean."
Yeah.
So how can we just kind of hunker down and, you know, stay as safe as possible?
Yeah, if we can't go there, we better just find our own peace somewhere else. And mm-hmm. yeah, I don't blame him on that. I don't blame him on that. I actually think that if Melkor hadn't interfered here, the men would have torn themselves apart more effectively. Because
that's an interesting thought, yeah.
It's actually the deception of Melkor
right.
that brings them back together.
Right.
He gives them a common enemy.
It's not that you did the thing, it's that you lied about it to me.
Yeah. What did the president know, and when did he know it? I hate that. I hate that line of questioning, because the real question is, what were the crimes committed? That's the question.
But, absolutely.
But we as a society love a scandal, and we love when we think that that something has been hidden from us.
Yeah.
We love to discover it. And so we're so much more concerned with what did the president know and when did he know it than we are what happened. And that's true in this story, too.
It is. Now you're reminding me of way, way back when Melkor came out of his 3,000-year solitude and is starting to spread lies.
Mm.
There's some reference to the fact that it was the sort of knowledge that the people who held it felt wiser than the people who didn't know it. And the people who didn't know it felt disadvantaged. And it's that same kind of feeling of, oh, well, I know something you don't.
But there's also a bit in that same section that I'm thinking about now where he tries to push his luck with Feanor, goading him more, and Feanor pushes right back. And it actually goads him into the opposite.
Yes. So you're right about that. You know, Melkor and Morgoth doesn't always really understand creaturely nature, shall we say.
I think Sauron's actually better at that than he is.
Oh, yeah.
Sauron is a much better manipulator. Morgoth is a much more blunt instrument on this kind of thing.
Definitely. He's a nihilist, and Sauron is a tyrant who wants to have a world to rule in. And his amazing insight, which the Rings of Power did convey very effectively, find out what they fear and give them the means to overcome it. And then they're in your hands.
Right. That's such a great line.
Paraphrased there, I know.
Yep. Shall we talk about Haleth?
Oh, I can't wait to talk about Haleth.
Can I tell you, I completely forgot about the story before rereading it.
Seriously?
Yeah. Wow. For some reason, it had wiped from my mind.
Wow.
And I reread it, and I was like, wow, this is heartbreaking, this whole situation. So we've got a guy named Haldad, and you could remember that because he's got dad in the name. So he's the dad of these other people. That's the last joke in this section.
Seriously.
And he's in the House of Haladin, and they're living in peace, you know, living the life. And Morgoth gets very angry because he realizes his plans for men have failed and they're thriving. So he sends orc raids to the House of Haladin. And Haldad and his son Haldor die, but his daughter Haleth holds the people together until Caranthir comes to rescue the men. He invites Haleth to settle her people north, but no, Haleth and her people refuse, instead settling in Esthelad. So remember, that's the place where Finrod had initially taken the men to have a permanent settlement.
Right.
Eventually, she forces everybody with her, basically, through peer pressure, to go further west. And those who remain with her settle in the Forest of Brethil, which is part of Thingol's realm.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yep. They're only allowed to do that, of course, because Finrod brokers a deal that Haleth's people will guard the pass against orcs, and Thingol will just be quiet and be less of a baby about people in his realm.
Yeah, and that section in particular delivers one of my favorite pieces of dialogue where Finrod reports to her, okay, this is what Thingol has said, and I'm not going to get the wording exactly right, but as close as I can, all you have to do is, you know, keep the orcs from invading. And she says, where is my father?
Right.
Where are my brothers? The thoughts of the Eldar are strange if they think I would ever ally with the slayers of kin.
Right.
You know, it's just boom, boom, boom. Come on, Thingol, wake up.
She goes, did I stutter? Yeah, it's so, you know, that was a lot of facts that I read, but essentially what you need to know is there's this tragic story of a descendant of the House of Haladin named Haleth who leads everyone. Those who follow her, because some fall off the path, go, I think some of them go into Eriador, some of them scatter into the different realms of the Noldor, but the people who follow her end up in Doriath. It's not within the Girdle of Melian, but it is within Thingol's realm.
It is. And she leads them through that horrible midway section between the Girdle of Melian and the crazed mountains, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in her way, she's showing as much strength as does Arathel.
Mm.
Because she, you know, she says, yeah, I know this is terrible and we got to keep going. And they do. And this settlement is going to be very important in the future stories about the children of Húrin.
Hmm. Well, we'll have to wait for that one. You've already signed on to that. So you signed on to that earlier. I think I remember with one of the first Silmarillion stories you came on, you said, well, I'm calling of Turin Turambar right away.
Yeah, which is ironic because it's such a depressing story. And
it's
yet,
really good, though.
The roots of it are grounded in Finnish literature, and I want to convey my own sense of this character, who so many people, you know, just really dump on a lot.
I think he's really fascinating. I do think he is extremely flawed. But hey, this isn't about Turin. Point is, we're going to end up doing about two podcasts at least on that. So let's just save it for that. So you've got some lore details, some history details on Haleth.
Yes, I think that she may be inspired by Ethelfleda, the Lady of the Mercians. She was the daughter and oldest child of Alfred the Great of Wessex, who became king of the Anglo-Saxons. And she was raised in the royal household, and she was taught reading and all kinds of things that were unusual for women at the time. He arranged a marriage of Ethelfleda to the king of the Mercians after the two people, the Wessex and the Mercia, had been warring together. And so this was a means of cementing their alliance against the invading Danish Vikings, because Alfred became known as the Great because of his defense against the great army that came through. And some people say that he saved the notion of an Anglo-Saxon England. That if he had not defeated them, you know, England would look very different from what it is now. So she went with her husband and ruled with him for a while, but then he died shortly after they had their only child, who was a daughter. And Ethelfleda carried on as the leader of the Mercian people, following in her father's footsteps of building burhs, or burgs, some people might call it, which are the earliest form of villages or towns, which Alfred basically invented. So that instead of, you know, you have all these scattered farmsteads all around. Well, if you create a burg, when somebody says, hey, the Vikings are coming out of the river, everybody can flee to this fortified place. There's always stores left there. And they can have their cattle and their goods in there. Mm. And it's much more defensible. So the Danish didn't want to be, you know, fighting a siege. They were smart enough, smarter than Sauron, actually, to know that there were better ways of getting what you wanted. And so they've just kind of give the burghs a miss and carry on. So she brought that knowledge and understanding to Mercia, which is includes London, but also stretches up north and over to the border of Wales. So it's rather a large territory.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So she also was initiating diplomatic relations with the Anglo-Saxon peoples in the north, which were, you know, very much on their own at this point. She would appear at the head of her armies and with her husband when he was alive, contributed a lot to the consolidation of Mercian culture. When she died, her daughter was named Lady of the Mercians, as Ethelfleda had been, but soon after, her nephew, Edward, supplanted his cousin and became King of the Mercians, as well as, a few years later, King of the Anglo-Saxons. So this is probably an inspiration for Haleth, but also for Eowyn.
Wow. I mean, that makes sense to me. I mean, the whole succession bit in Rohan, too, feels very tonally in line. I know it's not exactly the factually in line, but very tonally in line with this succession.
Yeah, and leading her people to something that maybe not all of them agreed with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, becoming respected, you know, the whole scene when Eowyn is made designated as the one who will watch over the people in the king's absence. I think there was probable, I don't know if there's direct evidence, but it certainly seems likely. And I believe that Mercia included the realm where Tolkien always felt that his Suffield ancestors came from. So this was the region of this particular form of Middle English that he found in Gawain and the Green Knight that he so resonated with. So there's a lot of sort of personal connections here for Tolkien.
His known language, right?
Exactly, exactly.
The language he felt like resonated
he
with.
He already knew it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a period of intermingling after this, but that was interrupted at some point
to you found could say so.
New Mannish realms. Hador of the House of Marach was a man in service to Fingolfin. He is given by Fingolfin lordship over Dor Lomond, and that's going to be an important place, so remember that. Dor Lomond, he becomes the mightiest of the Edain. And again, this is all by the judgment of the elves, so I do like that they're like, you know, Fingolfin's bestie was actually the best man. We gave him a medal.
Because Fingolfin was our high king, after all.
Yeah. They are actually the people who are going to create what becomes Adonaiic, the language of Numenor.
Very cool.
And then from Hador will come Húrin and Túrin. They're going to come from that house. And like you said, Marilyn, we're going to talk about that at length later on. And then Dorthonion is given to Boromir, familiar name, but not familiar person.
Not that's
the grandson of Beor. That is not Sean Bean.
No.
And from Borowin comes Morwen, who is the mother of Túrin. So again, we're uniting these lines in that. And Rian, how do you pronounce that?
Rian,
okay. Mother of Túr. And Barahir, father of Beren. Now, Beren, everybody knows Beren and Lúthien is a big story in the Silmarillion. It's sort of the flagship story of the Silmarillion.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah.
Probably the one closest to Tolkien's heart because of the resonances with his own personal experiences.
Yep. So we've got the two Mannish realms here, Dor Lomond and Dorthonion, to remember. And then just know that a lot of important people are going to come from these lines. It's so funny. These few paragraphs where I outline this from are so biblical. This is exactly how the Hebrew Bible is written, of this person was this person's son, and from this line will come these. And you know, the Hebrew Bible is read. It's written to be read annually, and it's written to be read regularly. And so when... The whole idea is when you're telling these stories, you go, oh, I know the story of Túrin, right? And so I think Tolkien really wants to emulate that here, right? You know, you're rereading the Silmarillion and you're going, so that's how that links up. And so it's sort of trying to wow the crowd by name dropping. I love it. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that they're all cousins together there, right? All this intermingling and so forth.
Yeah, the last few chapters of the Quenta Silmarillion are really going to center around these people.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And two people who never actually speak to one another, but do cross paths at quite a critical moment in their stories of their lives.
Right. So we close out by saying, you know, the men of the Edain do have longer lives than their predecessors, because I guess they're living among elves. They're eating, you know, they're on the elvish diet, they're on the Mediterranean diet. But the Eldar are still, like, very shocked when Beor the Old dies willingly of old age.
Yeah. With no illness, no wounds, no injuries, just, okay, that's it.
They were just completely taken aback by this. But we see here, you know, we talked a lot in The Rings of Power about the willingness of men to die.
Right, that struck me.
And how going away from the willingness to die is how you die faster, and also how you go towards evil. And here we have Beor, who is supposed to be this giant of a man, just, and I say giant in terms of not his physical stature, but not size. He's just going off into the sunset, you know, he is just ready to be with Eru Iluvatar.
Yep. I've done my thing. I got my people across the mountains. I entered mm-hmm. service with the one I consider to be the finest of all the Noldor.
I made a best bro, Finrod.
I had descendants, and gee, one of them might be one of the most famous humans of all time. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, that's the chapter, Marilyn. Do you have any other parting thoughts for us?
Always, of course, women like to have more of the stories.
Yeah.
And we get details on just a few of the people, most of whom, as I think we've already discussed, will wind up being important in the great tales,
yeah.
as Christopher called them. You know, the Beren and Lúthien, Children of Húrin, and the Fall of Gondolin.
Yeah.
So I guess, as so often happens, I'm left with the feeling of, oh gosh, I wish Tolkien had written more.
I know. But so we've got not too many things to remember from this chapter, I would say. You could forget most of this chapter and the rest will make sense to you.
No, that's true. That's true. It's for, you know, genealogists and historians and culture folks who like culture.
I think you could just remember from this chapter, if you, you know, obviously read the chapter and enjoy it, but you could remember, I think Haleth is a great person to remember in that whole story.
Yes.
And then for facts that you should remember, just remember they've got Dorthonion, they've got Dor Lomond. Those are going to be major havens for men, and that we have the Forest of Brethil. That's going to be another important area. Mm-hmm.
And just taking a look at the map and locating those names that John just gave.
Yes.
I think it's helpful in physically situating yourself in the stories and understanding the locations and the distances and so on.
I'm looking up right now. So Karen Wynn Fonstad made the Atlas of Middle-earth. It is a really excellent resource. I have it myself.
Absolutely.
This has all the maps of Beleriand and whatnot. So go check that out if you want some physical maps. If not, just Google Maps of Beleriand and you'll be happy.
Yeah, no, it should be included. And for those of us who got the edition of the Silmarillion that has the tipped in map that unfolds carefully so you don't tear it from the book.
Oh, yeah.
It's all in there too.
Right. All right, everyone. It's been another fun month of Silmarillion stories. Let me just take you into programming notes. Our affiliates are going strong. Check out the Silo coverage on Woolshift Dust. I believe they're on episode 8 this week. And Alicia's got her own supercast and Patreon going on where she does spoilery talk and other bonus content. So go check that out on her feed. You can get to all the affiliates in the show notes. You can also find coverage of Spirited Away on the Radioactive Ramblings feed. I think they're going through all the Ghibli movies and they're going through all of the Red Rising series of books. Then on Nevermind the Music, they just dropped a Wicked episode on Defying Gravity. On top of their weekly coverage of all things music and psychology. It's a really great show. I'm really enjoying their coverage, especially lately. I know they've been getting into some rivalries with East Coast, West Coast, so go check that out. It's a great time. Properly Howard is still doing their season on a few good films, and soon they're going to be covering Severance with us weekly. So check them out and make sure you subscribe to our Severance feed because our coverage is only going to be on there. Again, our coverage of Severance will only be on the Severance feed. You can find that link in the show notes. Please go subscribe ASAP. On the Lorehounds feed, we have this, you know, Silmarillion stories. The Agatha wrap-up is finally coming out, so you can check that out soon. We just did the Doctor Who Christmas special, a Wicked one-shot, plenty of stuff going on. And then, of course, Severance is right around the corner. Again, subscribe to that feed in the show notes in the link tree. And we'll be there with weekly coverage. We're trying to get screeners. Not sure if we're going to get them. But if we do, we will do that right after the episode embargo lifts. Now, before we go, I just want to thank our Patreon and Supercast subscribers, as well as our Discord server boosters. So starting with Discord server boosters, Aaron K., Tiller the Thriller, Dork of the Ninjas, Doove71, Athena A., Tina, Lestu, Nancy M., Ghosts of Partition, Radioactive Richard. And Lore Masters, Samartian, Michael G., Michelle E., Brian P., SC, Peter OH, Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Doove71, Brian8063, Frederick H., Sarah L., Gareth C., Eric F., Matthew M., Sarah M., DJ Miwa, Andra B., Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T., Alex V, Aaron T, Sub-Zero, Aaron K, Dally V, Mothership 61, Gnarls, Kathy W, Listu, Jeffrey B, Elisa U, Neil F, Ben B, Scott F, Stephen N, and Adrian. Thank you, everyone. Great times as always. Join us next month for the next chapter of The Silmarillion.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.